Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part two is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into an inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org.
All right, today we're going to be doing a quick one, I think, on the shadow in the Jungian sense. So the shadow is essentially anything you are afraid to look at. It can be repressed emotions, repressed desires, can be sexual, can be anger, can be a lot of different things. But essentially, it's whatever you don't want to look at and whatever you repress about yourself.
Yeah, and so a lot of this gets formed in childhood. Because as kids, obviously, we express all of the different emotions and all of the different behaviors, and some of them get positive responses like, oh, you're a good boy, or you get a treat or whatever. And then the other ones you get reprimanded for, or get sent to your room. And so you start to learn pretty quickly that, you know, certain behaviors produce good outcomes and certain behaviors produce bad outcomes. And so you start hiding or suppressing the bad behaviors because you want to have your needs met, obviously. You don't want to get sent to your room without dinner or without dessert, or you want your parents to buy you that video game that you really want. And so with time, all of those emotions and behaviors just get suppressed, and until they stop being part of who you think you are. Because, you know, as you get older, you develop the sense of who you are, develop this personality. And a lot of those things end up being outside of your awareness. You know, you think of yourself as a good person, therefore you're not angry or hateful or jealous or lustful or, you know, misbehaving in any number of ways.
Yeah, we've seen this play out a lot in the last decade, I would say, in sort of this demasculinization of the Western world. This idea that most forms of expression of masculinity are toxic. That aggression is not useful in modern society. Dominance is not useful. Any of these sort of like physically active, sometimes violent urges are just not welcome. And what ends up happening to little boys who are told that this isn't okay is over time they start to repress those feelings, those urges, and they feel impotent, they feel weak, they feel repressed in their let's say, repertoire of emotional expression. Like, for men, a lot of the most common forms of expression when there's like difficult emotions to express comes out in anger.
Yeah.
So a society that tells them anger is not okay, there's no form of anger that is justifiable to express, whether it be physically or emotionally or verbally, all of it, all above is not okay, then you can kind of see this sort of crisis of masculinity that's been happening with young adults, males especially. I think there's another aspect of this where not only does this affect men, it affects women.
Yeah.
This repression of masculine tendencies, because it's not like masculinity is just man and femininity is just women. It crosses boundaries, right? That's something we've been learning, I guess, in the I don't know how you would say it, modern interpretations of gender. That gender is fluid, all of this stuff, which I guess in some ways it kind of is, but it's like, I do agree that people can possess both sides of the spectrum, but we're looking at masculinity as something that is mostly full of negative qualities. Mm. So when those tendencies tend to get repressed, we get very weak men, very feminized men, people who are unable to stand up for themselves. Unable to be physical or express themselves in any sort of physical way. And especially when for men, that's a strong desire to be competitive, to be on a team sport, to lift heavy shit and move it over there and be of use to women, you know?
Yeah. And it's funny because even saying some of the stuff could be considered politically incorrect these days.
Yeah.
That you would say that men are like this and women are like this, even though men obviously, on average, have far more testosterone and they have different physiology and their bone structure is different. And they experience life differently because of those things.
So we, you know, let's go get back to kind of a general repression, sense of repression in the shadow. So how did Jung define the shadow, as far as you know?
So his definition of the shadow was every part of ourselves that we are not consciously aware of. So it could actually be positive or negative. So you can repress positive qualities. For example, if as a kid you were reprimanded for being too spontaneous or too creative or, you know, starting to sing in class, even though singing might be your talent, but in class it's not appropriate, and then you learn that singing is not okay and you start repressing that urge. Mm-hmm. Or it could be something to do with your sexuality where you repress it so much because maybe your mom was very Puritan and anytime she, you know, caught you playing with
having
you.
Some R&R, having some recreational time.
Yeah, having some R&R. She would, you know, shame you and spank you and just like, you know, take away your video games. And you learn that sexuality is not okay. So then you end up growing up to be an impotent person.
Imagine, okay, like I think we need to get the timelines right here. You start masturbating probably around 13, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is mom really going to spank you for masturbating? Is she going to take that risk? No, it's not a real question. It's just,
I know,
like,
I know.
Obviously, she's not.
So when I was growing up, us kids were like exploring our differences in anatomy starting at the age of 6 or so. So we weren't exactly masturbating. We were just kind of looking at each other's junk and comparing it. So, yeah, we were young enough to get spanked.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's kind of a different thing. It's like looking over the fence at the amusement park and then the other one's like riding every ride, spending all day. Yeah.
So anyway, about repressing positive emotions, a lot of the time, emotions are actually linked. So if you repress anger, you end up repressing all high energy emotions in one way or another. Because it's not, you know, emotions are quite fluid. Sometimes fear and excitement can feel very similar in the body.
Actually, there's a system, I don't know, I don't remember what it's called. You probably know what it's called, where you try and like reprogram your reaction to things. So if you're feeling nervous before going on stage, people give you the advice that you should actually kind of rewrite that thing in your head as a feeling of excitement. Like you can't wait to go on stage and talk to people. And it actually does kind of transmute the emotion in your mind.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a term for it other than emotional alchemy.
Hmm.
Yeah,
but I mean, it goes across the board with other things like aggression and anger could be used as like exertion of will.
Yeah, it's very energizing.
Yeah.
For example, sometimes you see athletes trying to purposely get themselves angry before competition because it gets the endorphins going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So when we repress a lot of these quote unquote negative emotions, we actually end up repressing a lot of the positive emotions. So what can end up happening is that people just are unable to feel a whole range of emotions. They're unable to feel joy, love. They can't get in touch with their creativity. They can't get into flow. They just feel lethargic and depressed. And actually, at worst, this can end up causing mental illness. Like the epidemic of depression and anxiety in developed countries, I think has a lot to do with this. I mean, it has a lot to do with other things as well. But I think this kind of not doing proper self-care is definitely a big contributor to it. And then the other thing is that it can actually cause physical illness. There's a French doctor, and I can't remember his name, but he famously cured many, many patients of backaches and spasms, muscle spasms, by allowing them to release their anger.
Hmm.
So anger actually, not just anger, but a lot of the time when you repress emotions, they get stored in the body, in the muscle tissue, in the fascia, which is like the connective tissue between everything.
Yeah.
And it can actually cause physical illness. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like the placebo effect is a powerful thing. I don't see why it would be any different for repression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know, I think a lot of people actually use their body as kind of like a compass in some way of what's going on emotionally, what's going on mentally, like backaches and like for me, that's it. Like if I'm getting a backache or I have sore shoulders, sore neck, it's stress.
Yeah.
That's always it. It's not because I'm like not sitting properly, because I can go for weeks sitting improperly, but be in a really good mood and have no problem. But it's just that like little bit of like either financial stress or business stress or whatever. And it just like it compounds and it immediately tightens up everything in the neck. There are a lot of different ways you can unrepress the shadow. Why don't we talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
On the podcast many times before, we've talked about a meditation technique that I think works quite well. So we've talked about it so many times before. We actually had a meditation app that we're going to be relaunching in the next couple of months, hopefully, that will go over this technique. And it's basically three different styles of meditation. First one is focused mantra meditation. So you focus on an object or a word, a mantra, something that should have no meaning to you. And it's like, that's like a flex as far as like, if you want to compare it to lifting weights. Next one is open awareness meditation, open your senses, be aware of everything in the room. You can have your eyes open during this type of meditation. Thoughts come in, let them go. And then the third one is focusing on difficult emotions. So each process is about 10 minutes and you go through them 10 minutes at a time. Third one, difficult emotions. So anything that you recoil from, can be fear, can be anger, can be sadness, can be some sort of event in your past that causes you trauma. It could be some sort of thing you're afraid of in the future. Death of a family member or a loved one. Any of these things can actually work. I've gone through this for years and years and years, and this is sort of how I've been able to handle fear, especially as it has to do with entrepreneurship, taking big risks, traveling to new places, like making my home base in third world countries. Like that's, both of us have done this.
Mm-hmm.
So it really works to get past and uncover some of these things that you may have repressed at some point. And the fourth one we've actually added and are planning to add into the app in the future is going to be a loving kindness or gratitude meditation. So just to kind of like, you know, you've got the focused, which is the flex, you've got the open awareness, which is the release of the flex, and then it's almost doing the same thing. Emotional is flex and then gratitude is release.
Yeah.
So, I think this could be a really helpful thing. If you guys don't want to get the app, just set a timer for yourself on your phone and, 10 minutes at a time, try and go through this once a day. It's really helpful. What are some other techniques for actually getting over, or first of all, uncovering what you've repressed and then getting over it?
One of the concepts that we haven't talked about yet is projection. And this is something that happens when we repress traits or emotions within ourselves and we can't admit them, but they don't really go away. Like they need somewhere to go. So we end up projecting them onto others. So when we see another person exhibiting the kind of behavior or emotion that we're repressing, we have a very strong emotional reaction to it.
So this can be something that we hate in ourselves or something that we deeply desire in ourselves.
Yeah. So it could be something like rage, anger, hate, jealousy, desire for power or money, which is part of the reason why people are so obsessed with celebrities, because, you know, these celebrities are exhibiting traits that average people don't express in themselves or don't allow themselves to admit that they have.
It's no wonder we vote in the politicians that we do as well, because, you know, this lack of feeling of sovereignty and control and power in your own life, and someone comes along and offers an answer to every problem you have ever had in this like confident and empowering way. And you go, yeah, that guy's going to solve the problem.
Yeah, totally. So we kind of project this father figure into a lot of politicians and think that, you know, daddy's going to come in and protect us and solve all of our problems. And especially you can see this in times of chaos and turmoil and confusion, like we see in the world right now.
Like when we don't feel safe.
Yeah. Who we end up electing are these totalitarian populist leaders who are just, you know, strong-willed and come in with an iron fist and fix everything.
So we were talking about solutions or techniques to get over it. So what is the one for projection?
Right. So there's this technique that was pioneered or invented by Ken Wilber. I'm not sure. It's called the 3-2-1 technique. So this is where you take third person perspective, then second person, and then first person. So first, you imagine a person in your mind that you have a lot of emotional reaction to. And it's probably easiest to start with a person in your own life, like maybe it's your partner or a coworker or your boss, or maybe one of your parents. So somebody that you have a lot of kind of emotional turmoil with. And you imagine some of their qualities that either really upset you or that you're fascinated or obsessed with. So, for example, this could be on the negative side, it could be like a rage, hatred, jealousy. And on the infatuation side, it could be something like somebody so talented or beautiful, or they express their sexuality in this very free way. And so imagine them in your mind and imagine their qualities very vividly. And then write them down in third person. So, you know, he is so angry or she is so talented. Then you move on to second person. So you have an imaginary conversation with this person in your head. And you ask them, what are you trying to show me? Do you have something to teach me? Why are you doing this to me?
So this is what we've talked about quite extensively in the past before, which is seeking intention.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not listening to the words that they're using. You're trying to figure out what it is inside them that would produce the words that you're hearing. Right. So how would you get to the exact same place of saying the same words that they are? You have to understand their emotional state, their history, their background, and make yourself go into the same state that you would make the same decision and say the same things. This is a deep understanding of intention, not just I'm hearing you say words and interpreting those words however I see fit.
Yeah. But a lot of this also has to do with emotions and traits. So not
same
just,
thing, but
not
I mean,
just
that applies to what I'm saying too.
Yeah, for sure. And so here we're having this conversation, imaginary in our head, right? So it's no holds barred. You can say whatever you want. And then you record again your findings. Like, what did you ask and what did they respond to you? And then you move on to first person. So you try to, exactly as you said, you try to embody what it actually feels to be in their position. You know, how does it feel to actually embody these emotions? How does it feel to have these traits? Does it feel liberating in some ways? Or does it feel constricting, you know, et cetera? And then finally, you recognize that these are actually traits that you also have. And then you work to re-own and reintegrate them to become part of yourself again. And so this actually is a common practice when it comes to shadow work. It's a way to become whole. Because whenever we cut out different parts of human experience or different emotions or different behaviors, we just end up becoming smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And then we just end up in this tiny little box instead of being everything that we could be. And so this doesn't mean that, you know, well, humans have a capacity for evil and humans have a capacity to murder and hurt others. It doesn't mean that you have to just go out there and manifest all of those things. It means that you have to accept that you have these tendencies because you're a human being. Every human being has them because it helped us survive in the past, our ancestors. And then once you accept them and embody all the feelings that come with it, then you can wrangle them and then you can learn to channel that energy into something else. And actually, this is one of the things that I've noticed with shadow work is the immense release of energy that happens when you finally accept all of your emotions. It's like a fountain that suddenly comes out of nowhere and you just feel so alive, like every cell of your body is just lit up.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel the same way. This is like the technique that I use when I'm trying to let go of something that's bothering me in the day. Because for me, like I've done a lot of that meditation work that I've talked about before, and tried to dig up past memories and traumas. And now I feel like most of that stuff's kind of dealt with. I'm okay with my past. And now it's about new things that come in. And for me, every time something new that comes in is really upsetting, it could be, usually it's just business. So that's pretty much the only thing that bothers me nowadays. It will, you know, I feel triggered by it. I feel unsafe suddenly. And then if I remember fast enough, the thing I do is accept. I just try and be okay with the situation, just accept. I just, all it ends up being is I repeat to myself over and over, I accept the situation. And that's it. And I feel immensely energetic and revitalized after that process is done. It's not like I'm fighting against anything. It's not like I'm avoiding thinking about it anymore. It's just like, yes, that's the thing. This is the state. This is the emotional state I find myself in. I accept it. It's fine. Process. And then you're done. It's awesome. Super easy. You have something to add?
Yeah, totally. Actually, just reminded me that one of the things that can often hold us back is the fear of the emotion itself. Not even the fear of something that can happen, but the fear of feeling things, because we've been repressing them for so long, not allowing ourselves. And a lot of the time, it's things like fear. So fear of fear. Mm. We're afraid to be unsafe and to feel fear. And so we don't do things that could potentially produce fear. And so creativity is actually one of those things that gets completely decimated if you're afraid of fear, because it's all about the unknown. A lot of the time, you don't know what you're going to create. You don't know how it's going to come out. You don't know how people are going to react to it, if they're going to love it or hate it or just ignore it, which can sometimes be the worst.
I think you brought up an excellent point about how people react. People want to be perfect the first time they do something because they're afraid they're going to be judged. They don't want to iterate with feedback from other people. They want it to be perfect so that they will be judged as being perfect. And that fear of like not being perfect or being perceived as an idiot is what prevents you from ever trying in the beginning. So I think that's a huge, important point to take notice of there.
Yeah, and so a lot of things, anything creative, anything to do with art, anything to do with innovation, anything to do with risk-taking, with business, you know, with creating something that's never been done before, if you're afraid of being afraid, you will completely shoot yourself in the foot and will not even be able to start. And then it's funny because sometimes it's almost like a, you know, when there are two magnets that are just, there's like a force field that's preventing them from touching each other. Mm-hmm. So when you come close to that emotion, you're like, oh, I don't want to feel this. And you just do a 180.
Yeah.
And then because, especially when people are not aware of what's happening in their bodies, they're not aware that this is actually going on. Their analytical mind switches on and starts making up stories and excuses for why this is happening.
It's so funny how common that is, isn't it? Like you don't want to face the thing, so the intellect just justifies every single cowardly move you take in response to that.
Yeah, well, feeling. You know, I have a duty to my family and I don't want to disappoint my father and
I'll probably fail anyway. I don't know if this is going to work. So I'm not going to try. I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah. And you know, I'm not really that talented or that smart. And
Yeah. 9 out of 10 businesses fail. So I'm not going to try this. Yeah.
And actually, well, you know, the grapes are all sour anyway. I don't want them.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's stupid anyway. I never wanted it. So the next thing I wanted to... Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I just wanted to loop it back to projection. So, and this projection is again another band-aid solution. So we just project all of the qualities that we wish we had the nuts or the guts to embody.
The nuts or the guts.
Yeah, that we wish we could embody. We just project them onto others and put them on a pedestal and idolize them because we realize how difficult it has been for us to embody these qualities. And if these people can embody them and be out there and, you know, up on the stage and doing it and trying and failing, they must be superhuman. So people do this with, you know, people like Elon Musk or different gurus or teachers or, you know, Dalai Lama or whatever, whoever your personal heroes are, or musicians or celebrities.
Yeah.
Where we just think that they're gods or superhuman somehow. But actually, a lot of the time is just persistence and getting over fear and being in the right place at the right time, which again takes persistence and getting over fear.
And the getting over fear thing is really interesting. I remember having a conversation with someone quite recently about this, about how the thing that you're most afraid of, if you tackle that first, then it cascades across all of your other fears, because the thing that you've gone after that's really, really difficult, that really has that magnetic repulsion factor to it, once you realize how easy it is to get over that, it's like, wow, everything's comparably easy. Like I could at least attempt the next thing, you know? And then you get into a habit of like one after the other going through these things and you realize they're all not so bad. Like taking that first trip alone to some foreign country, or, you know, starting a business, or any number of things, asking her out. It's like, they're all kind of at the same level of like, that's a scary risk and I could lose really bad if I take this risk, but oh wait, it was totally worth it. Even if I failed, it was worth it. Awesome. Then what else can I try?
Yeah.
So it's compounds, you know?
Yeah. When you say it's easy, it's like, it's still challenging to go through
it. The act is challenging, but the dealing with the emotion becomes easy. That's what I'm saying. It's like when you get enough practice dealing with the emotion, it becomes easy. It's just practice of courage. It doesn't mean you're never going to feel it, but like the act of doing whatever might still be hard. But I think with enough practice, the getting over that fear gets easier.
Yeah. One of the other things is that we also have a lot of cultural baggage around certain things, or personal baggage, like, you know, maybe you have some childhood traumas around certain things, or a lot of cultural narratives around another thing. And so these kinds of things seem to almost like cluster. So a bunch of negative things will be clustered around each other. And so the fear of something might actually be associated with 10 other things that are bad.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Like, no wonder people get caught up in different kinds of neuroses, or like they kind of create a web of their own reality, convincing them that certain things are impossibilities in their lives and they never ever attempt anything that they would like to do. Like, I've seen this just in conversations between the two of us about different things, because we've been together like nearly 10 years now. So we've had lots of conversations that have related to like something I'm afraid of or something I don't want to face. And it's like, you start to kind of build these models of each other's minds and realize that like, oh wow, you've built an entire world that is like a reason that you can't do something. And you've got reasons and all stashed in all different areas. I'm not saying that's a thing that you do so much anymore, or that I do so much anymore either, but it's like, it's definitely interesting to watch the massive frameworks that people build, the massive stories, that the intricate, it's like Game of Thrones in someone's head, just all the reasons that they don't do something or do something. Yeah, it's really interesting.
And if you trace it all the way back, it might have been just some like
one little event.
One event when you were five. Yeah. And then just cascades and cascades, yeah. And perpetuates.
I want to kind of abstract a level up, and we've never done this before, so I'm not sure how to do it, but I want to talk about the collective shadow.
Yeah, sure. Let's do that.
Because that's a tough one, and it really requires that you are able to process your own stuff before you start
seeing the collective shadow.
Yeah, exactly. It's really hard to see the collective shadow because people have that tendency of thinking they're unique. Like everything they do is unique, and every problem they have is unique. And you know, they want to be special. It's a natural feeling. But I think understanding that like your problems are not that unique. Everyone's got something similar, and you look out at the world and you recognize, oh, this is like everything we've manifested in the collective world, materially or otherwise, is a result of how I'm afraid of this thing, and you're also afraid of this thing, and you're also afraid of this thing, and together we made the world that we live in.
Yeah.
Really fascinating when you see the kind of meta narratives that all comb together, that all collect and connect. So let's try and think of some.
Well, the point about politicians being a reflection of our collective unconscious and our collective shadow, I think, is a really important one.
Yeah.
But this also reflects in our institutions, because actually, as you pointed out very accurately, that a lot of this world that we've built is a way to avoid fear and uncertainty. It's not even so much, I mean, originally it probably was more to avoid dangers, actual physical dangers, but with time it became a way to avoid even feeling fear. And now you see the extremes of this happening in universities, where free speech is being taken away because people are afraid of feeling a little offended.
Feeling afraid, feeling triggered, feeling offended. Yeah, all of it. Man, yeah, I think you could just start with this one thing. How is the collective consciousness avoiding fear? How is it trying to feel safe? And you can look at any event. You can look at how Americans responded to 9/11.
Yeah.
How they voted in different politicians throughout the years going forward. You can look at the Me Too movement. Maybe we should come up with specific examples, actually. That might be more helpful.
Sure. Well, for example, build a wall, you know, the Trump slogan.
Yeah. We're
going to build a wall.
Yeah.
That's obvious. People are afraid of something. He's stoking up that fear. And it's not even that he's doing it. It's already there in people's shadow.
He's really just responding to what is already going on in the collective consciousness in the US. So that actually is a great example. Like, life isn't the way I want it to be locally, where I am, where I look around at my little town or city or whatever. Things don't work very well for us. There's a lot of problems with drugs. There's a lot of problem with crime. I mean, this could be any city, but let's just like make a pretend shitty city. It's hard to get employment. I haven't got a raise in forever. I'm about to lose my job, or so-and-so across the street just lost his job. Now you start to have this kind of collective feeling of things aren't right. There's not an abundance of what we need to live happily. And then someone comes along and goes, there's the problem. It's those guys over there. You know, provides a thing to point the finger at, and then offers a solution that collectivizes everyone, wraps you around this way to avoid the problem, the deeper problem, and it ends up being build a wall or deport all the Muslims or that kind of thing.
Yeah, or let's go to war somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's a little, we've oversimplified this a little too much, but.
Well, I think it illustrates what's happening, because a lot of the time people point at leaders like Trump or somebody else that they don't like or don't agree with and say, oh, it's their fault. They've done this. But they don't understand how all of us have collectively contributed to that happening. And because it's the shadow, we are unconscious of it, we don't even see it.
Mm-hmm. This is why we've been talking for so long. It relates to the course that we produced, a lot of interviews that we've done, a lot of independent episodes that we've done, about why it's so important to work on yourself before working on trying to save the world. Because I think this point about when you understand your own shadow and your own problems, your own fears, insecurities, you can begin to project that out into the world and understand like, oh, this is, I'm not unique. This exists all over the world. And if I'm trying to solve this problem this way by changing the world, other people are trying to solve it in the same way by trying to change me. Yep. Does that work? Do I want to change for the sake of someone else? Does someone else want to change for the sake of me? Should I like institute laws that prevent people from acting in a way that I don't like? It's like, it's all kind of the same, but this whole idea of avoiding fear, especially when you're, you know, you have a different background than someone else, you know, this could be divided, I guess, down the middle with left and right politics. It's like left doesn't understand the right, right doesn't understand the left. None of them want to understand each other. So you get this division, and then you've got this idea that I don't want to look at what makes me the same as those people, or what makes me feel insecure about the way they behave. So I don't want to even like begin to understand them. And now you start to enact policies that try and limit their ability to express and do what they do, how they see they should do something. Goes the same on both sides. So I don't know if I explained that well, but what I'm really trying to say is so much better to know yourself before you start to try and change the world.
Exactly.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Because a lot of the time you'll end up doing it just to fix some sort of unconscious problem that you have inside of you.
Yeah.
And you're basically trying to take away other people's sovereignty so that you could feel less afraid.
Yes, exactly. Anything else you want to say before we wrap up here?
Sure. Well, actually, somebody asked in the comments and wanted us to talk about with some things that we've learned from the first group of the course.
Is and that appropriate for this?
I think it actually really relates.
Sure.
Because, you know, we're talking about how when you do a lot of shadow work on yourself and then you talk to others, you realize that a lot of the stuff is really, really common. Like the patterns that people have are so incredibly common.
Yeah.
And this is something that we've noticed in our course as well. Like the problems that people have are very much alike.
Yeah, it's true. And they think they're so unique and this isn't a slight on anyone. It's kind of a normal thing to, because you're the only perspective you got. You know, you think your perspective is so unique, but it's really not. So many other people are dealing with the exact same shit as you do. They They have a phone. They have notifications coming in. They have work. They have, you know, they have to go to bed. They stay up late. They watch Game of Thrones. Like, they've got a thousand different things that they do that are completely similar to you. It's no surprise that they would have similar neuroses or problems or worries or wants or needs or desires or anything. Like, we have no idea how alike we are across the world, not just in our neighborhoods. So what we've noticed in the course is how often people seem to think their problems are unique, which prevents them from actually figuring out how to relate to others who also have the same problem and figure out where, you know, where we can help each other or where there's common ground. Or that's a huge one.
They think that their problems are unfixable, mm-hmm. because they're unique. Nobody understands me.
Yeah. And what's ended up happening in the course that I find so amusing is we've made a few lessons that kind of directly address some of the problems that we've noticed people have, either from, you know, talking to people in the group calls or from surveys and stuff. And what we've noticed is that people will come up and talk to us in private later after a group call or after a lesson's been released and ask us, like, did you just make that lesson for me? Like that,
and was that actually, example about me?
Yeah, exactly.
I feel so embarrassed.
Yeah, that's happened so many times now too. It's so weird. Like, we get all these private messages, like they really think, and I don't want to say it's narcissistic really, it kind of is a little bit, but it's like, it's totally fine. It's normal, but it's an interesting awakening moment when they realize, like, oh, other people have that exact same thing. It's not about me. This is the normal problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, how many times has that happened now? It's really funny.
Yeah. Another thing that's happened is another also pattern that is just so ridiculously common is that people, especially smart people, really love understanding things conceptually, but they don't know how to apply it. And they don't have any experiential knowledge of it.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that results in that attitude of like, I already know this.
Mm-hmm.
And they read the words and you get, I think there is some sort of internal recognition too. Even if you've never encountered that information before, you internally recognize it. Because a lot of it's just kind of common sense advice for being a human, right? But then they don't recognize how they are actually really bad at that thing. They think because they know it intellectually, they know it experientially, which is completely not the case. So that's why every lesson has got like a deep, hardcore kind of exercise to go along with it that makes you face the thing, makes you practice the thing.
Yeah. And there's multiple levels here too, because knowing something intellectually is one thing, then experiencing it once or twice is another thing, and then practicing it is another thing, and then mastering it is an even deeper thing.
Yeah.
So just because you know something doesn't mean you've experienced it. Just because you've experienced it doesn't mean that you can practice it or can show it to others how to do it, and doesn't mean that you've mastered it. And we're trying to aim for mastery, because a lot of the stuff...
Or at least experience. At least know the thing because you've done it.
Yeah. Any other patterns that you've noticed in the course that were interesting or something that you learned from facilitating?
People want connection. They're starved for connection. Yeah. And because of that isolating feeling of believing your problems and your position, your situation is so unique, you don't actually end up reaching out to other people very often to try and establish some common ground. So I find people are very isolated.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially the reason for the group calls. And that's the main benefit people get out of it, I think, is that you get to connect with supposedly like-minded people, but it's a really diverse crowd of people.
Very diverse.
It's just privately, they're the people who have tried to solve their problem by looking for a course or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a surprising, it's not really surprising though, but because I know people are depressed. I know people are lonely. It's very easy to see if you're just browsing YouTube or Reddit or something. But I guess I didn't realize how common the problems are,
mm-hmm.
that people have, how universal they are.
Yeah.
And what I'm most fascinated by is the link from what we're talking about, the shadow to the collective shadow.
Mm-hmm.
What our society manifests as when all of the individuals are afraid of the same kind of thing.
Or like have the same baggage or trauma.
It's just a light bulb moment when I suddenly like grasped all my own issues, my own fears and insecurities and problems, and then recognized them in everyone else, and then looked at the state of the world. It was like, whoa, this is so much easier than I thought it would be. You know? Do you know? Like, mm-hmm. so many things. But I mean, it's a problem of scale, though, because every single person has to have this realization on their own experientially. You can't, like, prescribe it to people. You can't just tell them. Like, everyone's got to go through this thing. And it's really hard. It's kind of like the process of adulting or growing up or transitioning into some sort of next phase of life that our culture does not provide any transitionary, you could say, rite of passage, ritual or anything. There's just nothing. So we just are, we're perpetually kind of adolescents.
Yeah.
Never crossing the threshold of becoming adults, never realizing that, well, exactly what we've been saying, that our problems are not unique. There's a, it's a collective thing.
Yeah. And speaking of the collective, there's this really interesting thing that emerged in the calls. So the first few calls, it was kind of everybody was talking about themselves and it was very disjointed. And then eventually, as people became more comfortable being vulnerable with each other, and as they realized that, well, actually, we're not all so different, then this collective consciousness began to emerge.
Oh, yeah.
And so what ended up happening is that people would just get into this flow state where everybody would say the right thing at the right time, but they weren't saying it for their own sake. They were saying it for the group's sake. Like, we were all, we all had little pieces of the puzzle, like a higher dimensional puzzle that we were all creating together, but none of us could individually see what that puzzle was. We just each had a piece. And then at the end, it kind of became revealed. It became clear. Oh, this is what we're all trying to figure out collectively.
And it relates to the suspicion that some of the people had about us making examples specifically for them, which we didn't. The same thing kind of happened in the group calls. It was like people were blown away by how the thing they'd been thinking about for the last several days manifested in the call. And they got the answer they were looking for from like four or five different sources in the call. And it was just like a story, a narrative was just forming of its own accord with everyone just adding little chunks of it.
Yeah, super interesting.
Yeah.
Apparently, a lot of people were experiencing synchronicities a lot.
Yeah.
I think with collective intelligence, the same thing is happening around the world where everybody's really confused and nobody really knows what's going on. And it's becoming harder and harder to make sense of what's happening in the world from an individual perspective. But all of us collectively are trying to make sense. And each of us has a piece of that puzzle. And I think that sometimes when people feel really lost or nihilistic, they feel disempowered, it's really helpful to remember that, that there's actually a greater consciousness that exists. And I'm not talking about in some woo sense. There's actually tons of research about collective intelligence and how it works. And I mean, it's been found in plants and animals and bacteria and fungi and subatomic particles. Like, literally everything that exists on this planet is a multi-species collective consciousness that's been around since the beginning of time. So it's something that exists. It's something that we're all a part of. And it's trying to figure things out, whether we individually know it or not.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, you know, I'm writing this script for this collective consciousness or intelligence video right now. It's a long one. So I'm doing a lot of research right now. And one thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is what is required to establish a functioning collective intelligence in a group, a small group or a large group. And one thing I keep realizing is that your desire to be perceived a certain way or to be, to do something, it's usually about your own perception. Actually, I can't really think of anything else. It's like
personal agendas, egos.
Yeah. Yeah. It's mostly about how you're perceived by the group. So one thing we noticed at the beginning of the group calls is people were kind of sizing each other up and some of them admitted this to us privately, like, yeah, I wasn't sure how I like fit in the group. And I was kind of like trying to size people up and see if they're, how smart they were. Am I smarter than you? No. Okay. I'm definitely smarter than you.
Or like, and then just like figure out where they
are. Yeah. Figure out where they are. Yeah. On the hierarchy in the group. I found that really funny. But then over time we kind of like established, I think through you and I being a bit of an example of it, like, okay, agendas are off the table. We're not doing agendas here. We are going to try and see what emerges mm-hmm. out of conversation with each individual expressing whatever kind of thing they want to express. Like, let's maybe deal with trauma first. If you got some issue, something you want to get off your chest, something difficult, let's discuss that. Let's help you through that. But then when we're all done, let's see where the conversation goes. And that's, to me, that's become the key thing that I've learned through the research of this video I'm producing, is that you have to suppress your ego and your desire for how to be perceived or to have an agenda. You have to suppress that and then let the group be the priority. And once you do that, it's fucking amazing what happens out of that. Like, I've never experienced that before. I've never seen it before, except for what you and I do.
Yeah.
Like, to me, it's just a one-on-one thing. I've never had it in a different context. But now suddenly it's in a group. I'm like, whoa, this actually can exist in a group context. So it gives me a lot of hope that the world could do this. Like, I don't want to think too big, but I mean, I do think that it's kind of a simple mechanism of creating a cohesive group structure. It's really about like, okay, suppress your own desire to be perceived a certain way and just be selfless. Just go for the group dynamic.
Yeah.
Pay attention to what other people want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that to loop it back to shadow work, sometimes it helps to do that acceptance first. That yes, you have traumas. Yes, you have issues. Yes, you have fears and insecurities. Yes, things might come up that might make you emotionally react, but just accept all of it. It's okay. You're fine. You know, you don't have to be perfect. You're part of this group. You're safe here.
This reminds me of another thing that we discussed in one of the calls, which was about when are you done? And I brought this up because a lot of people were discussing traumas, and I just kind of wanted to have a thought experiment, not trying to rush anyone through anything, but I was like, okay, when do you guys feel you're done? Like, you've processed all the traumas of your life, and now you can just look at the present and the future. And a lot of people at the beginning were saying, I think even you were saying this too, that you're never done. There's always something more to process. And I thought about that in a kind of like a cultural narrative context of like, what have we been told our entire lives going through school and the way we've been raised? What are people being taught in universities and high schools now about trauma and about trigger warnings? I hate to bring that up all the time, but it's really true. Like, we are collectively being taught that there is no end to fixing yourself, that you are broken. It's like straight out of the Bible, you know, you're sinful, you're broken. And no wonder we never get past that desire to like self-express and fix and express my trauma, because it's just, I feel like it's part of that narrative that just makes you keep searching for things that aren't necessarily there, or makes you keep reopening old wounds. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask the group, like, when do you get to a point where you're starting to make new ground, or you're starting to process things that are coming in? You're not adding to the bucket of trauma. You're just processing things in real time. And I mean, the group kind of came to a pretty cohesive agreement on it. It's not like you are done forever. It's about how quickly you process things.
Mm-hmm.
And the magnitude of which those things affect you.
Yeah.
So you're basically, if you think of it like a sine wave in an audio kind of context, you want the sine wave to shrink in frequency and shrink in amplitude, so that you're just one like thin line in how you process events. Does that make sense? Yeah. Instead of like every little event causing you to make a giant wave, and then you've got to take weeks to get over that thing, and then, or like a good thing happens and you're just like on cloud nine, and then you kind of recover from the good thing that happens and go into a deep depression for weeks after that. Like, really what we're trying to do is shrink your reaction time to things and then shrink how much it affects you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, because you wouldn't necessarily think that like shrinking how you react to positive things would be a good thing. But it actually is. I feel way more blissful not reacting, not having a strong reaction to most things. Just be like, this is the flow of life. It's beautiful no matter what happens.
Yeah.
That's so much better, I think.
Yeah, we agreed on that in the end.
Yeah.
Because I think that people weren't just talking about trauma. They were also talking about growth and self-development.
Yeah, yeah, so, I think there was that miscommunication there.
So when I said that you're never done, I meant that you're never done growing, you're never done awakening, you're like, life just keeps unfolding.
Yeah.
But yeah, with trauma, I definitely came to an agreement with that, that you do.
Because you've got a finite amount of time between now and the past. I mean, it's continually going, but unless you're like living in a fucking horrible set of conditions where you're every minute of your existence, you're adding new things, new traumas to your life that you have to process, which most people aren't. I mean, like really, we're in the Western world. You can't be constantly traumatized every minute of every day. So you have like a finite list of things, or a very slowly growing list of things. You can actually process most of that stuff. And you can start by going for like probably, let's say, 70% of the worst thing that you can think of. Go for the worst, or go for the 70% thing. It's not quite the worst, but it's pretty bad. And try and process that thing. Try and accept it. Try and sit with it. And then you realize like, oh, I can go more hardcore in what trauma I'm working through. And then what ends up happening, I think, is that from that 70% and onward level, you end up automatically clearing out everything below that. You know what I mean? So you don't actually have to sit there and battle in the sewer with every single little like microaggression or trauma that you've ever faced throughout your entire life. You kind of just clear all of that away because you've gone through and processed a big event that somewhat relates to all of those things.
Yeah, that does happen. I think there's another important point to note is that people's capacity to process emotions and deal with things has been decreasing lately.
Right.
Because there's too much stimulation, the nutrition in the food has been really decreasing, and there's a lot of, you know, sugar and all kinds of crap that they put into food that actually reduces your immune system and makes you less capable. And then there's all the distractions, you know, people are addicted to their phones, people spend a lot of time indoors, they don't go outside, like actually spending time in the sun and sun gazing, if you can get into that, is really, really good for your health. And it increases your immune system just by a you know,
vitamin D.
Yeah.
Just by sun exposure.
And taking supplements of vitamin D is actually really bad for you. It doesn't do the trick at all. Like you actually just have to go out in the sun. And so all of these things compound, like they're little compounding stressors that just reduce your capacity to deal with things.
There was one more point. I just want to get this last point out before we go, because we got to wrap it up here. But one thing about our modern lives that I find to be interesting, distressing, and very common, once again, is the fact that we all spend so little time actually letting the mind do nothing, right? And I was thinking about this generational difference between our connected generation, anyone basically post-millennial, and the baby boomer generation. So there's this demand of the environment for the baby boomer generation, which was basically just like, have a family, work hard, and you will have a good life. Like, take care of your people, and that's pretty much it. The one main difference I can see that technology and connection and internet and all of that stuff has created is this demand for thinking, high-level thinking.
Yeah.
And what I've realized in doing this podcast, and you're interviewing people whose IQ is just off the charts, and I actually have to like change my diet pre-interview to be able to keep up with some people. And like one of our most like favorite guests that we've ever had on the show sells smart drugs and obviously takes his own medicine, you know, Daniel Schmachtenberger. Those episodes are like everyone's favorite. It's because he's so intelligent, so articulate, and Jordan Greenhall as well. And I don't know if it's the smart drugs or not, but who knows? But it's like, what I'm saying is that the brain consumes a lot of fucking resources, a lot of resources.
Yeah.
So we're living in an environment that requires so much more thinking. We're always on, we're always scrolling, we're always communicating, we're always like doing work, we're always thinking about what has to happen next, because there's so little time to actually just relax And if you take that time to relax, you're actually giving up opportunity. Like, there's so little to go around, or at least that's the attitude that people have. Doesn't mean it's necessarily true, but people feel like there's so little to go around that they have to constantly be striving to get ahead. And so when the way to get ahead relates so much to thinking, hard-nosed, like grinding kind of thinking, it's no wonder all we want to do is veg after, browse, do escapist type things.
We were talking about techno music, yes, and the rise.
This relates.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was in the gym today listening to the shit ass music they have in Bulgarian fitness centers, and it's just like repetitive techno, repetitive, repetitive, repetitive. It's in that build up and drop, you know.
Or EDM, whatever they call it. Yeah.
It's fucking terrible. I hate it. I mean, I've come from listening to like Tool and metal and all kinds of stuff. Intricate.
Jazz.
Yeah.
Classical.
Yeah. So I was like, what kind of environment produces a culture that makes this music the most popular music? That makes like people that creates a demand for this music. I was like, why? And you know, we recently made a friend who was talking about techno and like really explaining it to me, because I don't get it. Like most electronic music, I just don't get it. I'm like, this is so repetitive. And she was explaining that it's actually about the feeling it produces, which is generally about escaping your head, right? I was like, oh, okay, I get it. Because I like being in the head. You know, I like Tool because I like thinking about what's happening. I like the layers. I like, you know, I really like to be engaged with it. And if I go to a Tool concert, I'm probably going to just sit there like this and like be thinking, nodding my head and thinking. I'm not going to be dancing or anything. So, yeah. So this relates. So this escapism from being in the head, because yeah, that's the most common feeling that people have. They're always in the head, right? Always worrying about the next thing, always having to focus and never getting that chance to unfocus.
Yeah.
And like taking some ecstasy and going to a rave or going to an electronic music show is like that one time of the week or the month or the year that they really truly get to release. And I stopped pretty much at that moment, I stopped hating the music. Like, I don't like it, but at that moment, I actually felt kind of bad for the culture that needs that escapism, you know, that creates that demand for that kind of thing.
But so, there's a lot of things too. People use meditation for the same reason.
I know. There's so many things. I mean, so much about the modern world of entertainment and all the things that people tend to spend the most time on when it's not work is really about getting out of the head, escaping something, living in some fantasy world. So I wish we could have like a reclaiming of the brain, of the head, of thinking. Like, I wish we could reclaim it so it was fun again.
There's the other side of it though too, because, you know, it relates to the people that we're talking about in our course who just want to understand everything intellectually and don't want to experience it.
It's a habitual problem.
Yeah. So it's a problem that's kind of both sides. I think it's like the disconnection between the body intelligence and the logical cerebral intelligence, because we have different kinds of intelligences in our body. Obviously, you know, we're multi-billion year old organisms that have spent all this time evolving, and like, it's an additive process. We've just added, you know, systems on top of systems. So we have different ways of perceiving the world, making sense of things and processing things. And
since we're so disconnected from the emotional and the body aspect, we just think like the intellect is all that there is.
Pretty much. You know, if you ask a Western person where their self is, they would often say, in my brain. That's me.
Yeah.
But that's absurd. You know, if you guys haven't listened to our episode on deconstructing your identity, where we talk about, you know, your ideas of what's you and what's human, we talk about that. Like, there is no center, actually.
Well, there is a center. It just doesn't exist in anything that you typically identify as. There's nothing, there's no memory, there's no system, there's no state that you can like latch onto and say, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
None of it. There's just awareness, which is not thinking.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with thinking.
Yeah. So disconnect, right? And the shadow work actually really helps, because then you get to unrepress all of your emotions and feel all the things that you've not allowed yourself to feel. And you connect to the body, and then you become healthier. You release all the stress and maybe pain. Or a lot of the time people have addictions too, because they have repressed emotions and their body is desperately trying to get some sort of a feeling that you've been denying it. And it gets it in the only way that it knows how.
Yeah.
By a video game or drugs or porn or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, well, what's the solution to that? I would say just like...
Feel your feelings.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, feel the feelings, accept, but also set aside time to just be off.
Yeah.
I mean, I need to take my own advice on this. We've been working so hard lately and not doing that. But like... that's what meditation is supposed to do. And that's why having a meditation practice, that's why practice is always associated with meditation, is because you have to like make it a daily thing.
Yeah.
Set aside time to do it.
Yeah. And also taking sabbaticals from technology and from thinking or planning or whatever. Just have a day, you know, every week or every couple of weeks or every month, whatever you can set aside. Just unplug.
Yeah.
Unplug from thinking, analyzing, planning, and technology.
Yeah. All right. Are we done?
Yes.
That's it. All right. Thank you guys for listening. Didn't expect this one to go so long, but I guess we just have a lot to say on this subject. What else do we want to say here?
Check
if you're interested
our course.
In the course, go to courses.futurethinkers.org.
We've worked on it quite a lot. We've spent the last 6 months more than full time working on the course. So...
Yeah, I stand by it. It is really good. So, okay, that's it. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to Future Thinkers. For all the books, resources, and mentions from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/96. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part 1 is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part 2 is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into your inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org.
Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.